doesn't accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
November 9th, 1989. History is made. The Berlin Wall falls. Years pass. Decades end. A new century is born. In 2021, one wall remains at Revolution Radio. The wall between Studio A, the Wisdom Circle, and Studio B, the Raw Deal. The wall falls. History is made. Wisdom Circle plus Raw Deal equals the event. James Fetzer. David Scorpio. Giuseppe Baffangolo. History is made. And now, the event.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer on behalf of the Wisdom Circle and the Raw Deal, welcoming our guest today, Frederick C. Blackburn, who is, remarkably enough, a former 32nd degree Mason and NSA whistleblower, who now hosts Blackbird's Breakfast Club podcast. He's done research into 9/11, the New World Order, the surveillance state, related issues. He's a perfect guest for us here on the event. And in Blackbird 9, as we may call you, I'm fascinated to hear more about the Masons. They seem to me to have played a very significant role in history, and yet we know less about them than we do about Skull and Bones. Welcome, welcome to the event.
Greetings, good sirs. Thank you so much for having me on the show today.
We are delighted.
Oh, and there's Mr. Scorpio.
Hey, Frederick, good to see you, man.
Good to see you, sir.
Blackbird, yeah. tell us about the Masons. I've been fascinated. I believe they've been making a real difference, but we know almost nothing about them.
Oh, that is definitely the rabbit hole. You know, my personal story, you know, if I can soapbox just for a moment, bear your indulgence, but I grew up in rural North Carolina. My father was military. He was a World War II veteran. I was Boy Scout, Eagle Scout, you know, Scout leader, et cetera. And, you know, growing up, you know, the Freemasons, you always thought were just another one of those civic groups like the Lions Club and the Moose Club and the Elks Lodge, you know, that they men getting together and doing good works for the community, right? So I just thought it was part of my path that, you know, you go to Scouts, you go to college, university, then you become a Freemason and you join the, you know, the junior leagues and et cetera, et cetera. And so in the 80s, I was living in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I petitioned a lodge there and joined and quickly rose through the ranks and did the Blue Lodge and did the York Rite and was planning to do the Scottish Rite. And then, you know, I took a job overseas and kind of lost interest in the Masons, and then came back to the States. I was took a job in Holland. I'm an electrical engineer by trade. I was retired, but you know, so I was always interested in the Masons, both from, you know, historical perspective and, you know, the community perspective. But it was after 9/11 that I had to go back and revisit what the Freemasons really are versus what the propaganda and the marketing tells you Freemasons are. And that was just, you know, that outsider looking in and saying, well, what exactly did I get myself involved with? What were these people's, you know, in, what is their end game? What are they really trying to accomplish? And that's, you know, I think what leads many people, you know, to the Masons is you start connecting the dots, and they, you know, the Masons always seem to pop up just like the usual suspects. And it's like, well, who are these people? You know, what is their model based on? And, you know, what are, is their end game? And are they a, you know, a force that is working against the people and working against the nation, working against the Constitution, working against the church? And you look at the history of the church and the Freemasons. And so there's just a lot to digest in that. And so I've been, like you said, in my Breakfast Club show, I tried to connect the dots of all that omitted history, you know, the lying by omission of history, that, yeah, they leave all those important little details out. And when you put those details in, you get a completely different view of history. So I'll be more than happy to, was to ask me anything, ask me anything about Freemasons. Yeah, we'll do an AMA show today.
Well, yeah, I'm very interested in kind of a thumbnail sketch of what you believe has been their role in history. It turns out that there are Masonic symbols at a whole lot of events where false flags are being carried out, leading to the suspicion that they're participants. Ole Domegaard has identified some of the clues that enables him to even predict where the next will occur based upon signs left behind at the last. I just wonder whether you've seen a tie-in here. I know even at Dealey Plaza reeks of Masonic symbolism. So any access route you'd like to use to approach a subject would work well here today.
Yes, well, you know, definitely it's a symbolism. And it's communication through symbols. And this is one of the things about all the esoteric schools, be it the Freemasons or, you know, you study tarot cards, et cetera, you know, the works of Manly P. Hall and all this, you know, the Rosicrucians and, you know, all of these groups, you know, use symbolic language, and it's a way to communicate to initiates and people, you know, that have, you know, been, you know, initiated into these societies that, the, you know, I know what those symbols mean. But one of the things about the Freemasons is, like anything, you know, symbols or words can mean different things to different peoples. And one of the things that I discovered that's deliberately part of Freemasonry is the what they call porch Masons, you know, the people that just think it's a good organization, they're given one interpretation of the symbols, but the inner circles, you get the more esoteric, more advanced interpretation of the symbols and definitions of the symbols. And then there are those symbols that I guess one of the biggest things that concerned me about Freemasonry once I started taking a critical look at it was the fundamental symbol of the Freemasons that everybody immediately recognizes everywhere is that symbol of the compass. And I'm talking about the drawing compass, like for drafting, not the, you know, nautical compass or whatever, and the square with the letter G in it. And what's so curious about that symbol is you ask any Freemason from an entered apprentice to a Grand Master what that means, and they will give you a wishy-washy, well, we're not really sure kind of explanation. Some people say it means this, some people say it's like that. And if you're, yeah, that's the problem. If your fundamental symbol can't be, you know, nailed down any harder than that, then that's a suspect organization. And so one of the problems I have with any blood or oath organization, which Freemason is, I'm ashamed to say that I took part in a blood oath, you know, group, is you basically have to take the blood oath before you even learn what the organization's about. You know, they say, oh, we're not a secret society, we're a society with secrets. You know, that's kind of pill pull, you know, just always making it sound like the right answer, but there's nothing ever really there. And so when you start to, you know, nail Masons down, well, what does the G stand for in that symbol? And they can't tell you, you know, that it should be a warning flag. And then, you know, you have people like Albert Pike who say in his Morals and Dogma that, you know, we're going to, in these advanced degrees, we're going to deliberately mislead initiates and then find our kind of people and then tell them what the symbols really mean. And so this was a direct, you know, a direct operation by these Masons that are going to fix the world. They consider themselves the builders that are going to fix the world and bring in the new world order. And one of their end games, every Freemason's working towards building the so-called third temple in Jerusalem for the Chosenites, you know, for, you know, and so it's like, why does this worldwide organization have for its end game to build this temple in Jerusalem? You know, so that's, you know, and what happens if that goes against the safety and security of the United States or what any other nation that these Freemasons are operating in? So at what point do these social groups become terrorist organizations or treasonous organizations that are trying to undermine a national sovereignty to replace it with this global type governance? So back to you.
One small question before I turn to Scorpio. I take it there's rather an abyss between a 32nd degree Mason and a 33rd. You made 32nd. Tell us about that gap, which I am inclined to infer is a very substantial one.
That is very key. That was also one of the things that I noticed when I started, you know, giving the Freemasons the critical treatment is, okay, we all understand Scottish Rite Masons go to these degrees here and York Rite Masons do these over here. But what is this 33rd degree? And they just tell you that it's an honorary degree. And then you look at people that have that degree and you say, well, what did they have to do to be awarded this, you know, prestigious honor? And so, you know, that nobody will tell you straight out, even if you're a Mason, you know, that, you know, we can't tell you what a 33rd degree is until you become one type of thing. And I know a lot of people have their speculation on what it is. My research basically moves towards the hypothesis that the 33rd degree Mason has basically done something to basically, you know, symbolically or literally shed blood for the progress of the order. And that's what made them, you know, a 33rd degree. And that's one of the huge things about the white apron, the lambskin apron, and the ritual sacrifices that are symbolized in all the rituals, that, you know, this is, you know, a blood cult. This is, you know, they draw their heritage. They say that, you know, they claim that they are direct descendants from the original murderer, which was Cain in Genesis, right? So in the story of Genesis, you have Cain and Abel. And the other part of the weirdness is that, you know, in Hebrew mythology, they consider Cain to be the son of Eve and the serpent. And this is something that is also echoed in Masonic literature, that, you know, Cain was different than Abel and Seth. You know, Seth and Abel were both of Adam and Eve, but Cain was of Eve and the serpent. And so the Freemasons draw their...
Happy is the moment when we sit...
Sorry about that.
That was interesting. Happy.
That was an accident, sorry.
Operator error.
You were talking about Cain and Seth.
Yes, but so the Freemasons, you know, drew their, you know, Genesis story, their origin backstory from Cain and then Lamech, you know, and, and, you know, I urge people to go out and look at that little transition from Cain, who, you know, killed his brother because his brother won the contest. He was a sore loser. But instead of being punished, he kind of went to the land of Nod east of Eden and built a city. Now, so he was the first builder. And so it was like this, you're not being punished for the murder, but we're going to mark you. And anybody who tries to have vengeance on you, they will suffer seven times the vengeance. And then by the time Lamech comes along, he's telling his two wives how boastful he is for all the people he has killed and for the reasons he killed them. For, you know, I killed a boy for slighting me, you know, and that, you know, they say seven times vengeance is that of Cain. Well, hear me, you know, seven times seven vengeance is the vengeance of Lamech. And so, yeah, this here is where they're drawing their backstory. So, yeah, this is basically a blood ritual cult that is about bloodletting and, you know, the idea of, you know, a ritual killing, that this is done not for personal reasons, but for the good of the system, the greater good. And so this is one of the things that, you know, both with, you know, for Freemasons, the Knight Templars before them, to the CIA and the Mossad and all these other shadow organizations that hang out east of Eden in the land of Nod, is, you know, they are killers, they are assassins, they are saboteurs, but they're following orders, so it's okay. They are authorized to do this. And so it's that idea of an authorized system that's telling people, okay, this person is a target, you need to take them out by any means necessary, and the ends justify the means. And so that is basically what I've been able to piece together about the mysterious 33rd degree, is, you know, that that is, you know, moving from the theoretical to the practical, if you will, that they are moving from, okay, I'm part of the organization, I've, you know, paid my dues, et cetera, but now I've been called upon to actually put this into practice and actually carry something out. And I did it, and so I'm being rewarded by this honor status. That's kind of how I see that mysterious degree.
Well, while I have questions about genealogy and how from Adam and Eve with sons, they have other children and offspring, if that does not involve incestuous relationships, how it's to be explained. But I want Scorpio to take the lead here, my friend Scorpio.
Oh, great. Thanks, Jim. Frederick, this is a fascinating conversation, and I think you're really piecing together some important information. And, you know, of course, there's lots of references to Cain in Masonic literature, an alliance with Cain. And, you know, you have the Tubal Cain symbol that the Masons use. There's a lot of other things that connect together with Cain. And, you know, there are inferences to there being a pre-Adamic race that existed on the planet. And, you know, I believe that the land of Nod was already civilized in some way, because they had women there available for marriage, and there was actually a name given to this place. So I think there was actually something there already that, you know, this implies a whole other civilization that was in existence at the same time. And, you know, I think also you're making a good connection between, you know, esoteric Freemasonry and the Kabbalah and Jewish mysticism, because I've heard Freemasonry at the higher levels essentially described as, you know, Judaism for Gentiles. You're essentially being indoctrinated into a Masonic and philosophical system that's very close to the Kabbalah in many ways, which I don't think is any accident. And of course, as you pointed out, the end game being for some reason to build this temple, to rebuild Solomon's temple. Why is that? I mean, of all the things that could be their end goal, why do they have that? I mean, it's awfully strange. So I guess my question for you, Frederick, is what was the weirdest thing that you saw going on? Like when you hit 32nd degree and we're at meetings and maybe talking to people privately, what was the weirdest thing you saw that sort of made you go, wait a minute, there's something a little off here. I don't know if I want to be involved in this anymore.
Wow. Which to pick, I guess. The to me, I guess it was that's a really tricky. As far as actual initiations, probably the last rite, the Rosy Cross initiation of the York Rite, which basically is prepping you to join the Knight Templars, you know, and they still have the Knight Templars reboot as part of Freemasonry. And you have to basically go through your Blue Lodge 1, 2, 3 degrees, and then your advanced degrees up to 32nd degree or equivalency, either York Rite or Scottish Rite. And then you can join the Shriners and the Jokers, and the levels, just inner circles, just keep going beyond that. But the Rosy Cross initiation is a candlelight ceremony, and you have basically the triangle that you always see, that esoteric triangle of the circle surrounding the triangle, the equilateral triangle, with the points 3, 6, and 9, the hidden numbers. So that's the hidden triangle. And as part of that ritual, there is actually a human skull in the middle of that triangle, and the initiate has to drink the wine out of a human skull that's been cut. The cup top is cut off into a bowl shape. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely, you know, that blood ritual aspect of that degree that, you know, okay, I don't remember this from anything out of St. John, you know. And so you just kind of like watching this go on, and you know, you really say, well, what exactly is this? This is definitely not Boy Scouts. So what are we, you know? And so you then looking at it as a game theory model. Like I said, I'm an engineer. I look at things in game theory. And, you know, you brought up the point of it being a Jewish organization. Just like communism, you know, Freemasonry is from beginning to end a Jewish model. Mm-hmm. And just like the Knight Templars before, it's basically you have this inner circle of Jews that are the hidden power. And then you have, you know, the Gentiles that are rising up in ranks and always trying to, you know, go to the next level of rank and next level of privileges, etc. So it from a system perspective, you know, it is a Jewish model. And so I go back to, what is the objective of Freemasonry, and what does that G stand for? Well, instead of it being God, which they always dance around that, I'm wondering if it doesn't stand for Gentile Goyim, because it's basically Jews trying to build a system of Gentile men that will serve Jewish interests. And so they're trying to build the perfect men to be servants of Israel, which is what Shabbat Goy are supposed to do. You know, Judaism is by axiomatic definition a master-slave system. It is a very, you know, racist system that they consider themselves, you know, the masters of the planet. God gave it to them, and everyone else is supposed to serve them. And so Freemasonry is a way to train, you know, the best of the and brightest to serve the people of Israel, to serve the Jewish people. And so they act like Cain and Lamech serving God, but they're outside the system. That's the thing. You see, you know, there's one of the things that's curious about that section of Genesis is from that point on, you have two bloodlines. You had the bloodline of Seth, and you had the bloodline of Cain. And it's like, who survived the flood? So that's always the question, you know, which Lamech, you know, bloodline really built the ark and survived the flood according to their genealogy. But back to you.
Scorpio, further questions? Or Giuseppe? Giuseppe, go for it.
Well, first off, it's wonderful that you're here, Blackbird 9. I've been an enormous fan of your effort. You put together nearly 250 brilliant shows with your Blackbird 9 Breakfast Club, and you just pulled the plug. Yours was one of a handful of must listen to weekly shows, and I still miss it. And hopefully you're coming back with something new here in the near future. But my question is, throughout your brilliant run of shows, you continually applied your game theory model, and you looked at, I think it was 8 or 9 historical epochs or levels. To you went as far back as you believed recorded history allowed, and you revealed some fascinating insights into the matriarchal epoch and such, and all the way to the last century and the push by Satanists, Moses Hess and Theodor Herzl and the other traitors, dual citizen traitors, who sought about to, and now they're achieving their goal, 110-year goal, to destroy the United States. And I'd like to ask you, I know you've mentioned in some shows that you had a successful business. You were a contractor serving the government's informational needs, and then you spoke out about the scam, a false flag of 9/11 done by the Israelis in the Rothschild minions, and they really sought to destroy you. I mean, I know you mentioned you lived in your car for a while, and how did that all come, that type of acute trauma, how did that all cause you to expand your vision and see this game theory and see what's actually going on? Because honestly, I feel like you get it more than just about anyone else I've ever come across.
Well, what was the old expression? We Southern boys don't go out looking for a fight, but here we are.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Nevertheless, here we are. First part of the question, yes. My nine-layer model of history, I was trying to make this as simple as possible. What is the old thing? KISS, keep it simple, stupid. And I was a engineer, electrical engineer, communications engineer, and I worked for think tanks. I worked for Research Triangle Institute in North Carolina for a while. It's in Research Triangle Park. Then I went to work for IBM. I went to work for various other startup companies and came back to IBM. And was doing started doing more and more course development and training than actual international support. And it was about in the late 90s, I got recruited for a company called Global Knowledge out of Cary, North Carolina, to put together a series of courses and labs of this new thing called third generation telephony, where we were going to take the computer network and the telephone network and the new cell phone networks. And these three were like the apples, oranges, and bananas, never the three shall meet. And we were going to squish them into one network and call it convergence. And this is going to be, this started the third generation network, fourth generation, now 5G telephony. But I was brought in to train manufacturers, businesses, intelligence agencies, military, law enforcement, governments, you name it, in these classes about how we're going to be migrating your features. And one of the things we used was called the seven-layer OSI reference model. And for those who know what I'm talking about, you'll recognize the phrase, please do not throw sausage pizza away. And that was the mnemonic to remember the seven layers of the model. Please do not throw sausage pizza away stood for all the various levels. And what we did was we broke all the networks down. So this is the physical layer. That's the logical or the data link layer. And then that's the logical layer. And then this is the presentation up to, the very top layers. So when I was developing this historical timeline, well, instead of a seven-layer model, we're going to use a nine-layer model, okay? And what I did was say, okay, T9, we say, and I always try to keep it light, keep it, fun, I know we're dealing with very dark topics, so the less black pill, the better. So it's like, okay, we'll keep this light, keep it simple, and we say, okay, T9 is way, way, way back yonder. And that's, the beginning of time, and time's infinite, so we're looking at an infinite direction on the time axis that way. And I say this was inorganic development. Okay, then T8 way, way back yonder, organic development. Then T7 way back yonder, 500,000 to 50,000 BC. This is when Homo sapiens show up in the archaeological record. Okay. Then T6, we had the last great ice age, 50,000 to 22,000 BC. T5, this is where I break down the zodiac into basically four sections of three sections each, where I say the gold era is basically one great year from where we are now. Okay, so if we look at Copernicus' book, he said, you know, the three great cycles are the day and night cycle, the yearly cycle, and then the great year, which is the time it takes the zodiac to go all the way around, which is about 26,000 years, 26,400 something, you know, and change. And so I said, okay, let's take one great year from where we are now, the last time we entered the age of Aquarius, and that would put us right at the end of the last great ice age, about 50,000 BC. And then I break it down into, you know, each of those ages, like, you know, the Aquarian age, the age of Libra, the age of Aries. And so T6 is, like I said, the great ice age. T5, the gold era, we start with the zodiac, 22 to 16,000 BC. T4, the silver era, 16,000 to 10,000 BC. T3 is the copper era, 10,000 to 4,000 BC. Iron era, T2, 4,000 to 2,000 AD. And then where we are now, the light era, 2000 AD up through 8000 AD. So here we are in the present at T1. So that was my strategy for that historical timeline. And then, you know, to basically plot my data dots along that timeline, so you can see these transitions of how civilization grew and developed and had setbacks. You had floods, you had volcanoes, you had earthquakes, you had comets striking. And it's like, okay, what were the echoes of these past civilizations, their value systems, what they were based on, and how did they change as the new systems would come in? And one of the things that's interesting is the virtues of one age become the vices of the following age, which I always thought was very, very interesting when you start, you know, transitioning through that, you know, things that were completely accepted in one epoch are now considered taboo in the next. And you can see this reflected in things like Deuteronomy. You know, if you go through Deuteronomy and it's like, okay, why is there a law against that? Who would have ever done that, right? You know, it's because to us, it's kind of outside the norm, but you know, that was what they were moving away from, is, you know, these matriarchal fertility cult systems into these patriarchal systems of, you know, starting around 4000 BC. So back to you. Oh, then the second part was, remind me again where we were going with.
Oh, the second part was you were successful, and all of a sudden you noticed some gaping holes in the lies of 9/11. You brought this to certain people's attention, and they tried to destroy your life.
Right. They always say 9/11 changed everything. Well, it sure changed everything for me. They said, if you see something, say something. Well, I saw lots of somethings, and when I said something, first I got sucker punched, then I got B-slapped, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was backstage, you know, at all this, I was working with the manufacturers. I was working with the intelligence agencies. I was, you know, working with things like the NSA, et cetera. And one of the things about military and intelligence work is everything's so compartmentalized. You only see your little sliver of the world. So these people are working on projects and they don't really connect it to the big picture of what's going on. But as I was moving from military base, manufacturing firm to intelligence agency, you know, you start seeing a bigger pattern. And what I was seeing was that they were basically using this technology and this transition to third generation networks to set up a completely unconstitutional data drag, if you will, just a dragnet where they were planning to sweep up everything. And so there was all this illegal electronic surveillance going on, which we finally proved after numerous whistleblowers came forth, but that, you know, the telcos willfully were working with the NSA to grab up everything. And the curious part of that was this was in play before 9/11. And that's what I really want your listeners to understand. And with the exception of myself, the only person who really came out about this was the CEO of Quest, which is Joseph Nacho, if you remember him.
I do.
And he came out after 9/11 and said basically the NSA had contacted him and tried to force Quest to go along with this violation of the Fourth Amendment. And he blew the whistle on him, and they immediately took him out with all this trumped up insider training. But all the other telcos went along with it. And then on 9/11, you know, I became a 9/11 truther, you know, on 9/11. When I saw WTC-7 fall during its own footprint, it's like, that can't happen on this planet, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, physically impossible. And then the magic cell phone calls from the plane, I'm sitting there going, that is physically impossible with the, you know, with the circa 2001 cell phone technologies. There's no way you could have been at that altitude, traveling at that velocity, and be able to set up a cell phone call at a ground tower and have that phone call hang on and transition to the next cell tower to hold up a 5-minute phone call from a plane. That's just physically impossible. Because one of the things, if you remember in the early days of cell phones, as you transition from one cell tower's coverage to the next cell tower coverage, you usually drop the call because the handoff protocols just weren't there yet. You pretty much, you know, had to make your cell phone call from a stationary point, and you're driving down the road and suddenly you lose the tower and your phone call drops, right? And, you know, so they're trying to say that this, you know, all these phone calls were made that, you know, just completely were the selling point of the, you know, Muslim hijackers, the radical Muslim hijackers. All that narrative came from those phone calls, right?
Yep.
And so if you take that out of the equation, you know, what do you have left? But so I'm, you know, saying that's physically impossible. And so on the first anniversary of 9/11 on, you know, in 2002, I was living the dream. I had my home, I had my farm, I had my marriage, I had my business that was doing very, very well. I had just signed, you know, a 5-year contract where I was going to be doing all this course development. I mean, I was, you know, future so bright, I got to wear shades kind of guy.
Nice.
I was on my way with a political career. I was the county chair of my party. I was on the executive board for my state. I was a delegate to the national convention. I was running for North Carolina House in that election. In September, I released a article. I called it, "We Are All Palestinians Now." And basically in that article, I came out with, not only was the 9/11 story physically impossible and the NSA and the telcos are illegally spying on everyone, but the most likely suspects of who had the motive, who had the means, who had the opportunity, and who's benefited was Israel with their Odenyenin plan and the fifth column operating in the United States, mainly the Project for the New American Century group, the PNAC group, that were behind this, and that this was a false flag operation, and they're using this to basically do a shadow coup d'etat of the country. Well, what's interesting, that was released on Yahoo groups, and everybody who had privileges to delete it swears up and down that they didn't delete it, but that article just disappeared. Yeah. Right. And up to that point, there was, you know, that was one of the things about Yahoo groups. It's like, you know, once something was there, it was there. You know, you just didn't censor things. And so that was my first experience with a shadow type banning from a social media company. And, you know, you're foreshadowing things to come, definitely. But, you know, it just disappeared. But nobody would take responsibility for deleting the article. But by January, I think it was January, February of 2003, right after the elections, I was scheduled to fly out for a training, three-week training for Naval Intelligence in San Diego. And I went on Friday afternoon, like I always did, get my itinerary, because I was going to fly out on Sunday. And there was a flag on my account. I couldn't log into my account. So I called customer, you know, the instructor services, and, you know, knew the guy, you know, he's big bud. And he's like, oh, yeah, hey, Frederick, how's it going? You know, and he pulls up everything. He says, let's see what's going on here. And then all of a sudden he just, you know, deadpan, just total change of tone. He says, there's a flag here that says you are to contact the vice president of instructor services immediately. And I'm like, okay. So I call and basically get this stone cold Jewish woman and basically say my services would no longer be needed. They're canceling my contracts. And that was, you know, I said, I have a contract with you. So he basically said, we'll outlast you in court, and hung up on me.
Oh, jeez.
And all of a sudden, my phone stopped ringing. I was turning away business, up to that point, and then suddenly my phone stopped ringing. And next thing I know, I'm living out of my car in a tent for 2 years. Jeez. So that's basically my sob story of 9/11 truth.
Wow.
Those are just terrific points, Blackbird. A.K. Dudney, by the way, a professor of computer science from Western Ontario, noticed that immediately and took several flights with different types of cell phones and found that it speeds over 200 miles an hour, altitudes above 2,000 feet, exactly as you observed. They couldn't switch the towers to continue discussion. It was all fabricated. I believe the author of the script for 9/11 is actually today a professor of history at the University of Virginia, who is actually also the head of the 9/11 Commission. Who better to be in charge of investigating than the man who authored this script, Philip Zelikow by name, who had completed a draft of the 9/11 Commission report a year before he shared it with any members of the staff. So you're absolutely spot on about these issues. Scorpio, I'm sure you have many more questions.
Well, this is just a fascinating discussion, Frederick. And, you know, I thought the earlier discussion on Freemasonry was probably one of the best discussions I've ever heard. And, you know, now we're entering into a very fascinating topic, because we're sort of seeing how the controllers of the system, you know, enact that control over people who so-called get out of line. And it's interesting how, you know, you wrote this one article, and then all of a sudden, through a network, a sort of a covert network, they were able to put the kibosh on your entire career, essentially. Were there other things that happened that sort of gave you an understanding of how this network operates and how they enact control? And then I have a second part of the question after that, if you could.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, it got dark. I mean, these people, you know, you get the whisper campaign. I was engineer by day, musician, sound man by night, you know. So I was known in the state, I basically southeast region, as, you know, I did, you know, everything up to festival level sound down to coffee house, you know, club sound. You know, I was the sound man. I had a recording studio, and, you know, so just really hooked into the artist musician scene. And suddenly, you know, there's the whisper campaign where all of a sudden, you know, I don't get invited to parties anymore. You know, I'm not, you know, even asked to run sound anymore, right? And then you start getting the death threats, and, you know, our farm animals started getting killed and things like that. And, you know, basically the running you out type of thing. And, you know, so it does get dark. These people are very good at what they do. And I always talk about the meaning method, the five B's of the meaning method. And that are, they bully you, they bribe you, they blackmail you, they banish you, and then they bury you. If they, you know, if they can't shut you up anyway, they will kill you. And yeah. This is one of the things that's really echoed in those Masonic rituals, especially the third degree Mason, when the Goyim, Hiram Abiff, the best of the best of the Gentiles, who was there on loan from the King of Tyre, you know, after he designed and built the temple, you know, he's murdered by the three ruffians, Jubalah, Jubalo, Jubalam, and they are attacking him with the various symbols of masonry. And each one of those symbols, you know, goes along with these tactics. You were talking about getting in line, you know, bullying somebody to get back in line. If they refuse, then you try to make a deal with them, right? You know, what do you want, you know, to get back in line? And then, well, you either get back in line or we're going to release these pictures we have of you or whatever, you know? And so, you know, that way it was just the, you know, standard method that they had. And these people, you know, have this down. This is what they do. This is what they're trained from birth to do in this system. You know, you think about the Purim ritual of the Jews when they go through the book of Esther and everybody has audience participation, where every time Haman's name is mentioned, you have to drown it out with the graggers or shout it out. You know, you got to shout down the opposition. And then you got to cheer when Haman and his sons are all, you know, killed because they dared to stand up against the Jewish people, et cetera. And so this idea of us versus them, and once somebody has said that they are, you know, standing up to you, they're Amalek, you know, they're an uppity Amalek, and you can use any means necessary to take them out as long as it doesn't expose the Jewish people. You know, you can't put the Jewish people at rest, but, you know, anything you got to do, the ends justify the means. And this is their attitude. It is completely an intransigent mindset. This is a master mindset towards cattle, towards slaves, that you know, if you're a good slave, we'll reward you. And, you know, for all of those years, I was rewarded handsomely for my efforts of keeping all those banks and corporations and governments and militaries running smoothly when their computers would crash on them, right? You know, I'd come in and save the day, and oh man, I had steak dinners and, you know, whatever you want, staying at the best hotels, you know. But once I, you know, bit the hand that fed me, as they say, you know, it's a different story.
So back to
the second part of the question.
Yeah, okay. And, you know, you touched upon 9/11 and sort of the, you know, the gaping errors that were very, very clear to anyone who dared to, you know, look at the information. Yet somehow they were able to sell the story to the general population. And we see the same thing going on with, you know, Operation COVID hoax. There's just gaping errors. There's so many inconsistencies with the story that just simply doesn't add up. Yet they're able to sell the story to the general public. Although I do believe there's more and more dissenters and people that are so-called waking up and starting to wonder what in the hell's going on here. So I guess my question would be, how do you think they're able to make this sell to the general public, even though it's so patently obvious that the story is full of holes like a piece of Swiss cheese? And how much longer do you think that this will go on where they can just, you know, pump out a, you know, a load of crap and the general population goes, oh, okay, sure, yeah, that's great. So that, I guess that's my question there.
Yeah, well, basically, I always talk about funny humans. We are wonderful, wonderful, magical creatures, but we have our quirks. And one of the things that's funny about humans is the first story you hear about something, even if you later get contradictory information and change your mind intellectually, emotionally, you still go back to that first version of the story as if true, that there's some truth in that original story. And the more emotionally bonded it is through trauma-based programming, etc., the more you're going to hold on to it. It's like, you know, a write protected disc or cassette or something. Showing my age here, but talking about cassettes, but you know, you used to be able to write protect things so they wouldn't get written over. And so when you have trauma-based programming, yeah, that gets written in whether it's true or not. What you were told, that's, you know, as if true. And, you know, we always go back to the Bolsheviks, and they knew this, that, you know, a lie repeated often enough becomes the truth. They always, you know, try to, you know, pin that on the German National Socialists, but they were trying to warn against this cultural Marxist technique of, you know, that convincing lying. And then, you know, you move that forward to the Solomon Asch experiments in the 1960s of group conformity, where you have the authority person up at front telling the lie, but you actually have a confederate in your peer group that is repeating the lie. They know it's the lie, but they're trying to get you to go along with the lie. And so this was, you know, huge in American psychological experiments is, you know, if you have an authority figure and a peer group person repeating the same line, X percentage of people will go along with the lie, even if they believe it to be a lie, they're going to go along with it. Yeah. Other people will believe it, that, you know, well, if you say so, and then you know, the very few people that will rebel, well, then you take them out. And that's that, you know, far right of the bell curve percentile group that, you know, they understand the truth and they're going to stick by it. So basically you destroy those people. You know, this is a decapitation move. And, you know, you see this all throughout Jewish symbolism, Freemason symbolism, et cetera, about, you know, the best of the Gentiles, the best of the Goyim have to be killed. You know, that's just part of the thing. And that's part of the Hiram Abiff Masonic thing, is you're the best of the best. He knows the secrets. He knows the truth. We've got to get rid of him.
Right? Let me interject here for a second and play the finest example of acute trauma-based programming via the big lie. Here we go. Huh.
Watch the planes hit the towers.
I was watching with my roommate. It was approximately several minutes after the first plane had hit. I saw this plane come out of nowhere and just ream right into the side of the Twin Tower, exploding through the other side. And then I witnessed both towers collapse, one first and then the second, mostly due to structural failure because the fire was just too intense.
Obviously, there were a lot of people inside the buildings at the time.
From the 7th Precinct.
I mean, what a joke. What an absolute joke.
Harley Daly. Crisis actor. Yes, mostly due to structural failure. Everybody talks like that in New York, right?
Yeah.
And of course, it turns out it's not even physically possible that the Twin Towers could have collapsed, as he's suggesting, because as Chuck Baldwin, a retired high school physics, math, and chemistry teacher, has calculated, for every downward unit, there were 199 upward units. Collapse was impossible with those buildings. Just if you observe again, Blackbird, about the cell phone, we got other examples of physical impossibilities, because Flight 175 effortlessly enters a building its whole length in the same number of frames it passed its whole length through air, which would be physically absurd unless a massive 500,000-ton steel and concrete building provides no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft in flight than air. So once again, we see we're being told a fantasy. But the media plays such a role in constant reiteration, not allowing questioning or challenging. And the engineers, the experts who would be in a position to know that we're witnessing a fantasy, do not speak out. Their silence is damning.
There you there.
You want me to jump in?
Yeah, jump in.
Go for it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Excellent points. And that's the getting to the second part of this is, okay, how did our fourth estate, our American journalists, that you know, they're there, the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, and print all the, you know, all the news that's fit to print, right? And how do we have this unified mockingbird response to things that are obviously lies? And then we find out about the CIA, Operation Mockingbird, but also Unit 8200 in Israel, their intelligence IDF group, you know, the best of the best, that, you know, one of the first things that once Israel was established, Unit 8200 was established, and the first thing they did was bought a PBX system, an American PBX system, a telephone. I mean, up to that point, you know, American telephones were pretty secure. You didn't go in backstage to a phone company unless you were authorized. So American technology on their phone systems, it was one of the most secure networks ever. And so the first thing the Israelis do is buy a PBX system to backward engineer how the American phone system works, so that they could get in and start undermining it. And with all the deregulation of the phone companies, basically these Unit 8200 alumni, you know, come to Israel and start taking management positions in all of these startup telephone companies. And so by the time 9/11 rolls around, you have, you know, pretty much across the board an 8200 presence in both the telephony world and in the media world, right? And so who's got editorial control, you know, of this information? Suddenly you can't say anything about 9/11 truth, or you get the tribal treatment. You get shut down and shut up, you lose your job. And so many engineers and professors and scientists did lose their jobs because they tried to persist on the physics of 9/11. You know, the official story is physically impossible. Here, let me show you how. And so they become a target. And one of the things I've always speculated in my working hypothesis was the reason that they wanted this surveillance system in before 9/11 was so they could monitor those problem individuals.
Radio. Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope.
We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. The time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
The business from Studio A with David Scorpio and Giuseppe Vaffangulo and The Raw Deal, which I host. We're very pleased to have as our guest today Frederick Blackburn, a former 32nd degree Mason, NSA whistleblower, has hosted a show called Blackbird's Breakfast Club Podcast that's received rave reviews. We want to return to the conversation, but I want to interject just one question for you, Blackbird, which is one I raised in passing. When we talk about violations of, you know, the laws of, say, electrical engineering with the cell phones, the laws of physics, and the absence of collision effects with Flight 175 and so forth, it illustrates a general principle that violations of the laws of nature, physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth are impossible because they cannot be violated and they cannot be changed. So we know we're being sold a bill of goods, fabricated event or fiction when we encounter them. I return to this issue, which seems on its face maybe slightly obscure, but in terms of human biology, how do we go from Adam and Eve, one male, one female, to these multiplicity of children absent incest? I mean, is that an issue that needs to be dealt with by any group that takes the Genesis story seriously?
Oh, fascinating question. And I guess the way I try to address that in my timeline that we're talking about the first hour is basically to say you had two groups split off in the European development of civilization. And this has been symbolized in so many Genesis stories, creation stories. Carl Jung had an associate, Mary Louise von Franz, who did an excellent book in the 70s about creation story. And one of the themes in all these creation stories is always there was the other. You know, there's always that other people out there. And, you know, the Jews always see themselves as a separate race superior to Europeans. And so this idea of, okay, we were told that Neanderthals died out. Well, is that true? Because when we start looking at this new DNA mapping of Europe, then, you know, you see that you have, you know, the Cro-Magnon DNA, which is white Europeans, but then you have all of this Neanderthal DNA that seems to be in high percentages amongst the, you know, Jewish population, especially the Ashkenazi Jews. And so one of the things, you know, I look at is, okay, if you read Genesis literally, then where did these other people come from if they're not your siblings? So you have a default incest part to this equation, which when you look at, you know, the Talmud, one of the things that you see that's horrific to, you know, European civilized sensibilities is the justification of incest and, you know, this child abuse, et cetera, that is legal in the Talmud. So it's like, okay, these people, you know, as a people, as a belief system, then they've got no problem with this. So is Genesis to be explained because of incest? Or is it because they're writing about their, you know, bloodlines? And some people say Genesis is the genes of Isis, you know, that you have these bloodlines that were separate, you know, a nation apart from the other. That, you know, they were amongst all these Cro-Magnon, and they said, we are a different biological people. And I guess I approached it in those two descriptions of trying to explain that part of Genesis and the incest and how did you populate the people from Adam and Eve, you know, to today. So does that make any sense? Or?
Well, I'm going to leave it to those who want to try to make sense of it. I think it's a challenge that may be insuperable to those of us who believe in science more than we do in religion. Giuseppe, I'm fairly certain you had a further question, and then we'll come back to Scorpio.
Oh, absolutely. Blackbird 9, what are your thoughts on how the American public has become so obedient, compliant? I mean, even in 2009, well, let's go back to 76. The criminal cabal known as Big Pharma tried to roll out a vaccine for swine flu, and it killed 58 people, and Gerald Ford was aghast, pulled it off the stage. You know, every couple of years they cook up some type of gain of function contagion, release it, and then say, well, you have to get a vaccine for it. It never works. As recent as 2009, just a decade ago, they tried it, and they killed a couple hundred people, and all of a sudden, even 60 Minutes did a piece questioning, making a CDC muckety muck sweat. And only a decade later, you've got this dumbed down, goyim cattle obedient herd that, oh my God, you know, I don't wear a mask for me, bro. I wear it for you. And I don't take the vaccine for me, bro. I take it for you. And all these social justice warriors and all these virtue signalers. And it's just insane. And yet that's the new normal for these goofs. And what happened in 10 years to flip that script so completely where the average normie is just enslaved now?
Oh, yeah, it is horrifying the way that this has played out over the last two decades. And I agree that, you know, the same people to me that did 9/11 are behind, you know, I call it COVID 9/11.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go.
So take a normal flu season and use your media to basically a war of the worlds, you know, to basically say, oh, this isn't normal flu season. This is pandemic. And it just happens to be really hitting these white countries the worst.
Yeah.
Right. And so we have to have mandatory vaccinations. And so to me, yeah, this is so much smoke and mirrors to convince people. And then going back to the mockingbird, you know, that you're just selling it, and at the same time stifling any dissenting opinions and data. That's the, you know, it's one thing to silence opinions, but the other thing to throw out hard data, like we saw, you know, with 9/11. You know, it is a fact that Israeli operatives that had Mossad connections were arrested on 9/11 in vans and trucks packed with explosives. This is a fact, right? But right. You will not hear that on, you know, the Mockingbird media, because it contradicts the thing. You have people dying from these vaccines. You have untold numbers of mothers losing unborn babies. I am in just in this area, how many miscarriages we're seeing because of these pregnant women getting the jab. And, you know, but they just keep pushing like this is necessary, or else we'll never get to go back to normal. And so this is this, you know, false sense of, you know, reward and punishment that, you know, oh, well, we've got something bad and we locked down. And if you want to go back to normal, then you've got to take this experimental vaccine. And so just like reverse engineering 9/11, the old Sherlock Holmes line about, you know, once you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, has to be the truth.
Right.
And so you start asking yourself, who has the motive, who has the means, who has the opportunity, who benefits? And so you go to this group of globalists that want their new world order and have been playing the long game. I guess that was the big takeaway of 9/11 is, not only are you up against an enemy that you can't see, it's the hidden hand, the enemy in the shadows, but you're up against an enemy that has been at this for generations. And I go back to the rise of the Zionist movement in the 1800s when Theodor Herzl wrote The Jewish State and you had the first World Zionist Congress. And, you know, what were the objectives there was basically we are going to overthrow all the Gentile nations and bring in our own kingdom where we will be the God-men of earth. And it's interesting that one of the Rothschilds in France who kind of pushed this movement, this world Zionist movement that the communists, you know, Red Terror would come out of, the Holodomor would come out of, the Armenian Genocide would come out of this movement. They reprinted the 1489 letter from the Grand Sanhedrin. This is like the Star Chamber of the Jews, right? You know, the learned chicken swingers of Zion. And in 1489, the Grand Sanhedrin wrote to them in Spain, because they're getting ready to get thrown out of Spain for practicing their religion. And one of the things they talk about was, as for what you say about their making attempts on your lives, make your sons doctors and apothecaries, you know, a pharmacist, a chemist, a pharmaceutical company, that they may take away Christian lives. So here you see this, you know, ends justify the means, that we're going to use medicine as a weapon. And so they said this in 1489, and then they reiterated it in 1889 at the launch of the World Zionist Movement. And then you look at, you know, things like Operation Lockstep from, was it 2010 when that came out, that, you know, outlines this, you know, Rockefeller New World Order plan of using a plandemic to use a gene altering vaccine to depopulate. And, you know, so it's like, you know, to me, the vaccine has always been the objective, you know, to get this mass vaccination program. And once it's done, it's done. And one of the things about Unit 269, one of those other best of the best groups coming out of Israel, this is Ehud Barak's group, Bibi Netanyahu, as I call him. Yeah, they're all Unit 269 alumni. This is the special forces kind of guy, the best of the best. And, you know, they are basically pushing this, you know, New World Order. And so you look at how these pharmaceutical companies are using this vaccine, and they're all Jewish control. Pfizer, Moderna, you look at who owns those companies, who those CEOs are, and they're all hardcore Zionist Jews. And the motto of Units 269 is, who dares wins. And this is the the very essence of that Jewish mindset of chutzpah, which is, you know, you do it and you get away with it and it's a done deal. Mm-hmm. You know, we are beyond good and evil. We are, the ends justify the means. And this is that mindset of all the PNAC group as well. Yeah, the Project for New American Century, Paul Wolfowitz and all those guys, they were huge disciples of hardcore Zionist Leo Strauss, who basically came up with the idea of the noble lie theory, that 9/11 was based on. It's okay to lie about things if it's for the greater good. It's okay to do crimes if it's for the greater good. And so if your objective is to wipe out Amalek, then what better way to do it than to say, oh, we're trying to help you, trust us. Here, let us put this medicine in your arm that's going to either kill you, cause you life-altering side effects, drive you insane, or make you infertile. And once it's done, it's done. The ends justify the means. So back to you.
You're making so many excellent points, Blackbird. I'm really very impressed, including your observation that the Talmud endorses or promotes incest, which would explain the origin of the early Adamite family. Also, of course, about the vaccines. In fact, we have a world-famous virologist who's projected that everyone who's vaccinated will die within 5 years. When even we have the reports, the public reports of the massive number of medical maladies that have resulted, the deaths around 6,000 now from 1% reporting, implying the probable number is closer to 600,000 minimally. How can the FDA or the CDC allow these vaccines to remain on the market to continue to have approval? They have removed many products in the past when they had a tiny, tiny percentage of damage, the adverse reactions we're getting here and now. I do not understand why everyone isn't outraged about it, save, of course, for the cover provided by the news media these days, whereas Mitchell, our producer, has observed, the fourth estate has become the fifth column.
That's a great line.
Exactly. And, you know, that is the thing. Our American media, our journalists have become propagandists. They have become psychological warfare operatives at every level. And that's the thing that I guess was my big takeaway of trying to promote 9/11 truth and the exposing the illegal electronic surveillance, is going up against these editors from the New York Times down to the, you know, Raleigh News and Observer or the Watauga Democrat here in Boone, North Kakalaki, where I'm officially banned across all their platform. Because you had this hardcore Zionist family, the Adams family, Adams Publishing, and you might remember Cedric Adams from your World War II propaganda history. Cedric Adams was the guy in the Voice of the Midwest on CBS radio who sold World War II to the Midwest, right? His son, Stephen Adams, came in the wake of the Sackler opioid offensive, and that was a full-blown bioweapon offensive against white Christian America in the Bible Belt. They laugh about it. They called it hillbilly heroin. And all these white coats were out there basically being salesmen to these addictive drugs that destroyed families. They destroyed individuals. They destroyed businesses and basically decimated this area. So Adams Publishing moved in, bought up all the local papers, put in Jewish editors. It's like, why does Watauga County, that has a Jewish population, increases every day, mind you, we are being completely invaded from New York, Florida, and California. But, you know, at the time that this purchase was like 0.00000001% of the county population. But yet we've got this hardcore New York Jew editor who first thing he did was ban me, not only from my local newspaper, but across the entire Adams Publishing platform. So all the High Country Press in those Appalachian Mountains, they banned me, not because I had broken any of their community standards. I hadn't threatened anybody. I didn't use bad language. I was just saying the wrong things. So I had to be shut up, just like the New York Times, just like when I got banned from CNN for telling the truth. You know, this is what you run into with this mockingbird system. They don't want the truth. They are propagandists, and they need to be treated as such, in my opinion.
Scorpio, join the conversation.
Yeah, excellent points all the way around here. This is a fantastic interview. And, you know, I wanted to ask your opinion on two different, you know, big media events that are going on right now. So sort of a two-part question here. You know, I was curious if you looked into this seaside building collapse in Florida. It's awfully strange. There's a repeating pattern here. Lots of Jews, a building that magically collapses. And then, of course, for some reason, the IDF, Israeli Defense Force, comes out and helps clean up the rubble. So I just find this to be awfully strange. And then they collapse the rest of the building before they finish the cleanup, you know, because of this. There was a tropical storm coming and it might knock the building over. And so they had to, you know, collapse the entire building before they finished the cleanup, which, again, is very suspicious. Lots of shades of 9/11 in this whole thing. So maybe you could comment on that. And then I want to ask you about another big news event.
Oh, yes. That was definitely one of the stories that was all over our radar here, because when you start doing a deep dive on this, you see this overlap with the John McAfee of McAfee Software, and the McAfee supposed Jeffrey Epstein suicide in a Spanish prison, right?
Right.
And the story, as I understand it from going back and reviewing the John McAfee storyline, was he basically got set up by Obama's administration when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and he was trying to get evidence to prove his innocence. And so he says he donated a lot of laptops that had all of this virus software on it. And I think, like Seth Rich and Guccifer 2.0 and Sean Lucas and all, and Julian Assange, when they went looking for evidence about how the DNC stole the election nomination from Bernie Sanders to put Hillary up front, that they looking for that evidence and accidentally discovered the worst of the worst of the deep state with all the child trafficking, et cetera. I think the same thing happened to John McAfee when he started looking at this. He saw just how bad it was, and he claimed he had over 30 terabytes of incriminating evidence against the deep state, Hillary, Obama, etc. And curious enough, the address where that was supposedly stored was at that same apartment complex, that condo building in Miami. Okay. And so people have sent me so much video, you can actually see the squibs and the blasts of these, you know, obvious controlled demolition of this building. So my question, you know, is, was this a storage for the deep state information, Or was this building a yet another Mossad safe house? Were they running Mossad operations out of that? And they had to clean that up because, you know, Miami, is a huge hub for all of this Mossad operations. And so was that a center of operations that they had to clean up? So they blew up the building, or were they trying to destroy the evidence from McAfee? But the topper, like you said, was when the Israeli IDF special forces come in to take control of the rescue operation.
Yeah.
Like, why do we have a foreign military on U.S. soil handling this operation? And why is the Mockingbird media letting them get away with this?
Before Scorpio continues, I just want to announce we will be taking callers during the final segment. The number 540-352-4452. 540-352-4452. Our guest today is as intelligent, articulate, and knowledgeable as any guest we've ever featured. You may want to take advantage of this opportunity. Scorpio, continue.
Yeah, okay. And, Frederick, you're connecting a lot of dots here with this building. And I think, there's always, sort of a hierarchy of motives, and money is always one of them in any operation they do. Might as well make money at it while you're doing your false flag or whatever it is. And I'm thinking there's going to be a massive insurance fraud going on here. And I think a lot of the so-called victims are in Israel with a new identity, sipping, margaritas or something like that on a beach in Israel. Because, if you look at that pile of rubble, it really wasn't, the original pile wasn't that big at all. And they're claiming there was 130 something people inside of there. That means there would have been a body every couple of feet, man. I mean, the whole thing doesn't add up in any way. And now they're saying, there's lots of other buildings in Miami that might have the same problem. So I think we're going to see lots of insurance fraud as a result of this, and claims, damage claims, and other buildings that seem to be owned primarily by Jews, because every representative of the building was a Jewish person, a man or a woman, talking about, their building. So the whole thing is just very strange. And like you said, you can even see the little explosions, the squibs going up and down the building, and the building collapses from the bottom, not from the top, so the whole thing just stinks to high heaven. And another thing that really stinks, Frederick, is this concept that we have a billionaire space race, and Sir Richard Branson just sent this airplane thingy up in space. Now all the billionaires are from
this.
Listen to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it, that the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, that Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Scorpio, I know you were in the middle of a question here in part about this contrived space race, which has elements of absurdity about it. Go for it.
Thank you, Jim. So, you know, we saw this whole charade of the Sir Richard Branson, launch of his little space plane thingy. And then, you know, you've got Jeff Bezos just around the corner with his little dog and pony show. And, of course, Elon Musk is, you know, making rockets and launching satellites. And first of all, the idea that these people are making money from this is an impossibility. You have to be really naive to think, you know, that these people are making money from this. And I believe that all three of these so-called billionaires are just creations, so the public can look and go, oh, well, these are the movers and shakers, you know, while the real power elite stay in the shadows. So my question is, you know, Frederick, what do you think the purpose of this contrived space race is? Where are they going with this? And, you know, what's your perception of this?
I guess I always go back to what H.G. Wells was talking about in his work, Things to Come, where he was basically saying, okay, we're going to have a great war, and that's going to be the end of nation states, and you're going to have this group of elites, and they were the Freemasons of the future, right? And they were the ones who were going to lead humanity to the next epic in the space race, etc. And also Ayn Rand's book on Atlas Shrugged, and, you know, the John Galt, you know, suddenly all the elite disappear and you find out that they're conspiring to set up this new world organization to bring in the new age kind of thing. So to me, I totally agree with you that all these so-called billionaire geniuses like Mark Zuckerberg, echo, you know, all of this is theater. You know, we're putting these people up, we're propping them up, we're giving them good press, you know, and they're actors. Mark Zuckerberg did not come up with Facebook. That was basically a Department of Defense project called LifeLog that, you know, happened to be discontinued the very day that Facebook launched, for example. And you look at, you know, the Branson space race and everything, and it's so synthetic. It's, you know, just, it's so fake, but yet they market it in this unified Mockingbird campaign like it's the best thing ever. And so you just think, you know, where is this leading? And I think it's a kind of a demoralizing thing to make your average Joe on the street say, well, I could never achieve anything like what they're doing, so I should just, you know, accept my role as a plebe or whatever. these, you know, these Jews are obviously superior in every way. How could we ever compete with that, right? So to me, it's just very synthetic. Now, getting back to what your observation about the Miami building was, yes, you know, where are the bodies? You know, if you had that density housing, a collapse in the middle of the night, you would be getting a body part every foot. If you've ever done search and rescue for something really horrendous like that, you know what the, you know, how gross and disgusting. I mean, it's just horrific. And so you're looking at this rubble site, where are the bodies? And it reminds me of on 9/11, you know, over 200 Israelis were arrested right up, you know, before 9/11, on 9/11, and right after 9/11. So 200 of these people that have special forces connections with Israel, and they're magically just returned on immigration violations by Michael Chertoff, you know, never faced trial, no media about it. You know, the only people that talked about it was that December 2001 four-part Fox News story that Cameron did on the Israeli spying that immediately got removed from the Fox News website, didn't air. Fortunately, you know, we managed to save copies of it, but it's the same thing where, you know, where did they go? When we find out that Michael Chertoff just sent them home, and who's Michael Chertoff's big bud? None other than General Michael Fourth Amendment Hayden, who happened to be the person put in charge of the NSA by Bill Clinton in the run-up to 9/11. He's the one who was responsible for all the stuff I was seeing. And, you know, why has he never been, you know, charged with anything? Instead, you know, he was promoted, given awards, and he is now a national security analyst for CNN rather than being in jail where he should be. So, you know, to me, it's just so many parallels between Miami and 9/11. And
those also, those are so many excellent observations. We do have a caller, okay. Bruce from Texas. Bruce, join the conversation.
Hey, what an honor. And Frederick, I'm kind of surprised you're still alive, considering everything.
Can you hear him, guys?
Yes.
Yep, we can hear him.
Yeah, we can hear him.
How is this? Any better?
Oh, no, you're doing fine. Go ahead, Bruce.
All right. Yeah. Hey, Frederick. I found it interesting when you were talking about the blood sacrifice of the best of the Goyim shall be killed. And I'm sure you're familiar with the battle of the Alamo and the war for Texas independence.
Yes.
Go ahead, Bruce. We all know the Alamo. Go ahead.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, the movies you watch, it's all whitewashed history. And Sam Houston, who was sent by Andrew Jackson to Texas with a mission of delivering the state to the United States. He was a scumbag, but he, of course, the Masons ruled Texas. I mean, you can't go into a town with more than 500 people without finding a Masonic lodge. LBJ was a 33rd degree Mason. And so it's a strong force here. And it's just really tragic the way they've taken, just like 9/11, you know, our heroes, you know, our first responder heroes, when they actually sacrificed them on 9/11, and then they put them before the public as, you know, as almost like you know, almost like deities or whatever. The people who came to Texas in the early 1800s were escaping bank loans, or escaping the law, or they generally just wanted to make a new life out west, away from the federal government. So they came to Texas at the invitation of the Mexican government, who had trouble holding the territory due to the Indian problem. And so Sam Houston came in, and he had he swooned everybody, like, okay, we're gonna have an independent country. He talked to the Indians. He married an Indian, as a matter of fact, an American Indian.
I hate
and,
this.
And anyhow,
you're not very closely related to what we've been discussing all along. Do you have something more?
Well, I'll summarize. Okay, Jim, unless you want me to hang up.
What? Go summarize.
Sure. You seem to hang up on me a lot. Well, anyhow, you had major players who are stranded at the Alamo, you know, the political rivals of Sam Houston, Okay, and then General Santana marched north. He slaughtered. They had take no prisoners approaches. They had the massacre at the Alamo, the massacre in Goliad, and then finally he was defeated out in the East Texas. Okay, both Santa Anna and Sam Houston were 33 degree Masons. Okay, and it's only just come out 20 years ago that there was a secret handshake and secret signs were passed back and forth when he was captured and he was allowed to escape. And so basically you had a revolution that was actually a slaughter of political rivals, and a lot of people died. And that's the story. And that's all I got.
Thanks for that. Of course, bye. You want to comment on what Bruce is offering here?
Well, you know, I think he's touching on some good points, actually. You know, basically, I think it's hard to go to a town with more than 500 or 1,000 people anywhere in the United States that doesn't have a Masonic lodge in it. You know, I'm always amazed that every time you go into, there's a little sign, oh, the Masons are here. And so, you know, the network is pretty incredible. But of course, most of those lodges are just at that level, just social clubs and blue lodges. You know, I don't think any real action happens until you get up higher into the Scottish Rite kind of higher levels, you know.
Blackbird, do you want to add to this?
Yeah, just shout out to Mr. Bruce in Texas. Thanks for calling in. Yes, the history of Texas is very interesting. I did a show on the Lone Star State. You know, think about that Lone Star symbol. That's the Eastern Star, and just all the Masonic symbolism. But I think the key thing there is the method. You destroy, you assassinate your political rival, you blame it on somebody else, and you make them a hero. You put up a statue, you know, you whack Kennedy and you make him a hero. A good example is the FBI agent that was killed on 9/11 on the first day of taking the job for the security system working for Lucky Larry. You know, that was an assassination. He was the number one expert on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan. So he would be and he was the one who contested the findings, the FBI investigation of the U.S. Cole in 2000 that introduced us to Al-Qaeda and the boogeyman of Osama bin Laden, right? And that, to me, that was an obvious Mossad false flag, the USS Cole attack. But the idea is you take them out, and then you make them a hero, and that removes the sin from you. Okay, the mindset of these people is they are the masters, and the masters can never do anything wrong, so you always have to have a scapegoat to project your sins onto. I mean, what sane people, you know, tortures and sacrifices a chicken every year so that the chicken soul goes to hell instead of your soul going to hell, right? These are different people. Yeah, it's a different mindset. But anyway, thanks for the call.
Blackbird, I have a comment here. Demographics of the Calurgy planet work to destroy America via Hollywood movies, TV, mass media. How do we know this? Because it's official EU North American immigration policy to this very day. It's even being coherently pimped by the mass media and entertainment industry, with one or more interracial couples everywhere one looks. Usually such shows and commercials feature a strong, handsome black male sporting a beautiful white woman evidently afflicted with jungle fever, sometimes with mixed race, properly diversified children in the frame. That's not an accident or a coincidence. It's diametrically opposed to majority will. No rational population surrenders its territory and highly successful genotype to millions of unassailable, overly hostile migrants without a fight. I think there's a point there. Your thoughts?
Oh, I think that was one of the big learning curves when I was reverse engineering the New World Order, was discovering the Calergy plan. And I'm like, okay, I went to public schools, graduated with honors. I went to college, graduated with honors, and went to university. And all those, even took all the optional history classes, right? Why did I never hear about the Kalergi plan and all of that. And it wasn't until I started going down this rabbit hole of, you know, white genocide that I discovered the Kalergi plan and saw how it had been rolled out for decades by the mass media, especially Hollywood. And they've just been ramping this up ever since. And it is a warfare tactic. And you go back and you read, you know, the, you know, just, you know, the 1800s, you know, where did that the poem come from with the New Colossus? Yeah, that was Jewish propaganda, that they rebranded America as this land of diversity that, you know, and that was not what the founders intended at all. You know, if you look at the 1789 first, you know, the amendment, yeah, this is for white people of good reputation to come to this country and take part in the great experiment. And suddenly that all got changed when the World Zionist movement started. And it's like, we're going to be the great melting pot now from everywhere. And then you discover, you know, Kalergi joined the Freemasons and became a, you know, married into the Rothschild clan and wrote the book Pan-Europa and talks about the genocide of white people to create this new world order where Jews will be the royalty of the planet and everyone else will be like a dumbed down mongrel race similar to the ancient Egyptians and be a slave class. And they wrote about this, and this is what we're seeing. They're just ramping it up.
Here's a sequel comment. Earlier this year, Hollywood movie and TV moguls decreed the casting for all films and TV shows must sport a cast of at least 50% being people of color. If the black demographic of the American population is only 13%, why must 50% of a movie, TV show, or commercial cast be people of color? Aside from the black Mandingo macho type being cast in films, TV, and commercials, I also object to the depiction of Caucasian men as weak, gay, tranny, soy boys who are inane, stupid, lame-brained, and dishonest wimps. The question, who is running Hollywood and corporate media? But we know the answer.
Yes, the usual suspects. And, you know, when you go back to the beginnings of like MGM Studio, you know, these were hardcore Zionists, you know, the Jewish supremacists that were basically stealing Edison's technology against his will and turning it into a weapon. And they have completely adopted the, you know, Kalergi model and this idea of moving from, you know, affirmative action and equality. Now we have equity, which basically is putting quotas on, you know, how many white people you can have employed or in a movie, et cetera. And so one of the things I ran into after 9/11 was, okay, I've been blacklisted from my industry. Maybe I can get a job in some other field that I'm qualified for. And no matter how golden my resume, the response is always white men need not apply. We've got all the white men we need. Now, if you were color, if you were homosexual, blah, 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 we could, you know, hire you then. But, you know, white men need not apply in North Carolina now. That's just the de facto standard. And it's all because of this equity psychological warfare agenda for, and the end game is white genocide. They don't want any white nations to exist. They're Amalek in this mindset. So back to you.
Before we take another caller, Giuseppe, I'm certain you have comments you'd like to add.
Oh, I would just be curious what Blackbird 9 thinks of why the average white male has gone along with this. I mean, you know, 40, 50 years ago, None of the destruction of the European communities, European tribalism would be tolerated. And now all of a sudden you've got these social justice warriors and these gender neutral and these LBTQ, WTF mental defectives and the virtue signalers and all this weird, cowardly, faggoty bullshit, and it's only happened in like the last 40 or 50 years. Why do you think that the white male has collapsed so completely?
Well, one of my go-tos is always the problem with psychological warfare is it works. And it works very well. And shame and guilt programming on a child, especially, is one thing for an adult. But when you have a child in its impressionable years being told by his kindergarten teacher or his first grade teachers that he's bad because he's white and he's male. And that is what you are getting in Western countries, that white men are intrinsically evil. White men are the oppressors always. You know, we're the go-to bad guys in what's known as the Cartman drama triangle. You know, the Cartman drama triangle is you have basically the victim, you have the oppressor, and then you have the rescuer. And the Jews always set themselves up to be the rescuer, the allies that are helping these poor victims against those evil oppressors. And this is, you know, cultural Marxist strategy that they develop, you know, through the Talmud, through the Frankfurt School, through Columbia University, et cetera. You know, this is just, they keep building on the same model. But yeah, these young children, you know, are bombarded with this. And the other thing is the role the white coats played in this with these made up diseases and ailments and afflictions that seem to target very bright white children, especially the young white males, where suddenly you have this new thing called attention deficit disorder, and you have, you know, all these other things that have to be medicated. So you're basically destroying that child's will with chemicals, you know, it's a chemical castration, for lack of a better term, to basically turn these children into, you know, anything but a straight white powerful male. You know, that is seen as the anathema to them. And, you know, so you have this campaign going on for decades, but the people doing it always claim the intellectual, moral, and ethical high grounds. That's the maddening part about it, is we want what's best for everyone, so we're going to have to put your child on a Ritalin because they're just too smart, you know. And so that's what we're seeing. Back to you.
I regret that for our next caller, we have so little time, but Scaredy Cat, join the conversation.
Hi, Jim and Blackbird 9 and everybody else. Hey, two points, try to be quick, I will try. So you mentioned telephone privacy. And before that, I'd just like very much to say that Blackbird 9, I love you, this wonderful BB, and let's hope that this BB replaces the other BB in everybody's you and your ideas to replace and occupy our minds and attention and elbow the other one out of the one who did so much bad. Okay, so the telephone privacy. The National Security Agency, I heard all the raw data goes to the Jews who are stealing Palestine in Tel Aviv, that everything is filtered through them. What law can we target that enacted this? And is this under the executive branch of the presidency? Go ahead.
It was kind of hard to hear you, but thank you for calling. I always love your calls, Scaredy Cat. One of the big things that I was trying to prove before I got blacklisted in 2003, run up to the Iraq war, was I was seeing evidence of a back door behind the back doors. That, okay, the telcos and the ISPs are swooping everything up and sending it to the NSA, but I'm seeing those dark lines from the NSA going somewhere else. I was trying to prove where it was going, and I was blacklisted before I was able to finish. But in 2013, when Edward Snowden came forth, he proved what I was trying to prove, that there is indeed a backdoor pipe that goes straight to Israel where all the data, all the raw data of everything is swept up and sent to Israel in raw form. And so that was 2013 with Edward Snowden, and, you know, went back to the company Booz Allen and Hamilton, which was one of my clients, and they were writing the software for the NSA programs and the telcos. And it's interesting that a little connect side connection was Rabbi Dov Zakim, who was the account controller in charge of the Pentagon accounts division. He was not at work the day of 9/11, so his entire staff got killed by whatever hit the Pentagon, and he survived like Lucky Larry, but he's the one who lost all those trillions of dollars that haven't been accounted for, that Rumsfeld announced the day before 9/11. After he left the Pentagon, he also went to Booz Allen Hamilton. So you definitely have this connection between these military contractors, the Pentagon, the intelligence agencies, and Israel. So good call.
Jim, you're muted. You were feeding back, so I muted you. You have to unmute to speak.
Thank you, Giuseppe. I got to say, Blackbird, this has just been a sensational interview. I know that Scorpio and Giuseppe will both have observations they want to make by way of closing, but I cannot thank you enough. It's been a really perfect, just a perfect occasion to have you here. Scorpio, your final thoughts?
Sure. I just want to thank Blackbird for coming on, man. It's been such a great discussion, man. And I hope to have you on my show again, too. And let's keep the communication going, man. This been a great experience. Thank you so much.
Giuseppe, yours.
Well, yeah, Blackbird 9 is a national treasure, and we should have him on as frequently as we can, and want to thank him for coming on the show, and look forward to him coming back into the media, alt media, pretty soon.
Blackbird, add where...
Revolution Radio.
And I told her, I said, because God's in this show.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course.